Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal are the producers for the show. Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. We're pleased in this part of Focus 580 to have as our guest Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carle Clinic, and we're here to talk this morning in this hour about children's health. This is something that we have done in the past on a regular basis for a long, long time. We did a show with Dr. Bob Bojack, who was a great guy, and we're always happy to see him. And he eventually got to the point where he decided he had better stuff to do than sitting around with us. No, he retired, and we haven't really done it as a regular topic for a while, and something we wanted to try to get back to have this on several times a year, at least, to give people who are listening the chance to call in and ask questions about the children and the children in their life. So that's the idea. Whatever you might imagine discussing with a pediatrician, you call in here, and I know Dr. Hill will do his best to help you out. I think anytime I have a physician here on the program, I always try to say at the beginning, remind people that we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. There is a limit to what we can do. So I don't want to discourage people from calling, but I want to make sure people understand that. And then, of course, if you have a real problem, then you need to pursue that with your own doctor or someone who can see you or can see your child. But this is a place you can start. You can ask some basic questions, get some advice, and I know the doctor will do his best to help you out. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for local folks. 800-222-9455 for the long-distance callers. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. How long have you been a pediatrician?
I've been at Carle for 25 years, so I came right out of residency and started my practice.
So that's a goodly amount of time. I think one of the questions that we thought it would be interesting to talk about, maybe just a little bit at the beginning, would be over the time of your practice, say if you look at pediatrics today and pediatrics when you started out, so quarter century ago, mm-hmm. that's a pretty good chunk of time. What are the most important changes that you think you've seen over the time that you've been in practice?
Well, I think a lot of things are happening in medicine in general. And with the advent of the internet and information technology, we've just seen an explosion in terms of information available to patients and physicians, mm-hmm. which has been very handy. I think that has changed the face of our practice to some degree. Specifically for pediatrics, I think, you know, pediatrics is a very kind of prevention-oriented profession, and there's been lots of work and vaccines over the last 25 years. I can remember when I was a child watching kids grow up, but polio was a risk. I've seen kids with polio. Polio is no longer a problem in this country. When I became a pediatric resident, we had lots and lots of kids in the hospital with bacterial meningitis. Now that we've developed vaccines for the bacterial meningitis, you know, it's rare to see a child with bacterial meningitis. And, you know, we've seen great advancements in the development and administration of vaccines. I'm very impressed with what we've been doing the last 25 years.
Yeah. Certainly in that area, there are some things between the time that I was a kid and now. There are some of the same vaccinations are given. There are also some new ones. How has the number of standard vaccinations grown over the last 50 years?
It really has exploded. I think we were all concerned about the number of vaccines that we were giving at visits as they just continued to add vaccines to the schedule. Mm-hmm. When I first got out of training, we had a diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, a polio, and we were doing measles. At this point, we're doing those plus chickenpox, two meningitis vaccines, a vaccine for diarrhea called Rotatec. We have hepatitis A and B, and some new ones, some really good new ones up and running. Gardasil for HPV, which is human papillomavirus, which causes cervical cancer. So they continue to build, and I don't think we're done yet. But results have been very good, so I think most people are fairly accepting of the move.
Are now most parents deciding to, and you have to forgive me because I don't remember now whether schools are actually requiring the chickenpox vaccine. Is this something now that most parents are saying, yes, go ahead and add that to the list? Or maybe as a physician, you're saying, whether it's required or not, say we're recommending that, we think this is a good idea.
Yeah, there's two categories. One is the state requires certain vaccines, and chickenpox is one of them. They require one dose, but as of, I believe, last December, they are recommending that we have two doses of the chickenpox vaccine, just as we do the measles vaccine, because of the 15% to 20% failure rate for the vaccine. So even though the school's not requiring it, we're recommending it. Menactra is another one for meningitis. It's not required by schools. Gardasil probably won't be required, but we're encouraging. And I think most people, the great majority of people, are comfortable, even though I think there are always questions which are appropriate. And certainly we're willing to try to answer any questions that we can related to vaccines and safety.
The chickenpox vaccine now has been available in the United States for, I don't know, maybe four or five
probably 10 to 12 years now.
And it was in use elsewhere before that, so we have some kind of a track record. Do we still, though, is there still an open question about whether or not this provides lifelong immunity or not?
Well, I think what they've found over the last 15 years or so is that immunity is not 100%, that it with one dose it's more like 80%. With two doses it moves it up over 90-95%. So that's the impetus for the booster dose of chickenpox vaccine, which we're recommending now. The state requires one, but I think two is kind of the standard now, and the state will probably pick that up as a requirement just like they did the measles, mumps, rubella.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's been kind of interesting to see is that, particularly over the past couple of years, greater concern about pertussis, about whooping cough, and about the question about whether, in fact, you don't want kids to get it, so we vaccinate them. It had been thought to be not particularly a problem for adults if they got it themselves. The problem was that, though, if we have a reservoir of pertussis in the adults and they're ending up giving it to children, well, we don't want that. So now it seems that we're starting to think more and more about maybe we ought to be doing what we can to make sure that nobody gets pertussis. Is there going to be now, do you think, recommendations, or have there been recommendations about either vaccinating adults or perhaps after you've done your baby shots for pertussis, that sometime later in life, in adolescence or young adulthood or something like that, that we're going to recommend that people get a booster shot for pertussis, like, you know, maybe we're now doing. Well, people tetanus. Are supposed to do tetanus every 10 years. We're going to now be doing more pertussis for no matter how old you are, that periodically you're going to get a shot for that?
Yes. I think you covered the subject very well.
Yeah, I just blather on sometimes.
It's interesting. One of the new developments is the adult DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, which is whooping cough and tetanus. And we're going to be doing that. We're going to use that in teenagers instead of giving them just a DT. And we're going to recommend it in adults as well. Adults are the reservoir for whooping cough. A good pediatrician in Nashville did a study. She took all the people that had a cough for 3 weeks or more that were 18 to 30, and she swabbed them for whooping cough or pertussis, and 30% of those individuals' cough was from whooping cough. So those people go into an area, spread it, and unfortunately, small infants, if they're only 6 weeks old, they have not had a DPT. They're not protected. At 2 months, they've only had one. At 4 months, they've only had two vaccines. So actually, it would be very important for the infants, for the adults to be immunized, especially moms, since they're probably the reservoir in 30% of the cases of whooping cough that develops in children. And I think a lot of us forget about whooping cough, I'll tell you. I've been guilty of that, and somebody's had a cough for 3 weeks, and all of a sudden, bingo, you know, it's whooping cough and you forget. But it's not uncommon. We've had episodes and epidemics in this area every year.
Okay. And is that what's going to be the recommendation for adults now on the DPT? Is that going to be an every every 10 years?
Well, they'll do it like a tetanus vaccine, which is every 10 years. You can give that vaccine 5 years after a DPT or DT, but generally the recommendation is probably going to be 10 years. And that will be an adult. That, you know, the adults have a different committee on immunizations, I think, you know, in terms of, and their recommendations do come out as kind of separate from the kids. So, but that, I think that's the way they're moving.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carle Clinic, and he's here to talk about children's health. We can take, I'm sure, that he'll do his best. Well, whatever question you have can be about vaccinations, can be about illness, wellness, can be about behavioral issues, developmental ones. You know, he'll take his he'll take
I'll,
a shot.
I'll and give
if,
it a shot.
If he doesn't know the answer, he'll say, good question.
Don't know.
Yeah. But whatever is on people's minds, particularly the wellness, illness kind of stuff, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have an OBGYN who stops by here every other month and has been doing that for a while. And we certainly have talked quite a bit about the human papilloma virus, the problem there, the relationship between that and cervical and other kind of genital cancers. And certainly it is her recommendation. She thinks that the Gardasil is a good thing. And in fact, we just talked about it some when she was here the other day. I think that in some people's minds, some parents' minds, they're a little unsure about this. Mm-hmm. The vaccine hasn't been available very long. So, you know, there might be concerns about the possible side effects, long-term effects. And there, I think there is now some debate still about, well, is it something that is just recommended? Is it something that should be required? Right now, we're pretty much just talking about giving it to girls. Mm-hmm. And some people think, well,
What about the boys?
You know,
not fair.
It's not fair, yeah. or that's an incomplete way of getting at the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so what's your feeling about who should get it and when? What are you saying to parents about this?
Well, I think the first thing is new vaccines are always being monitored at every step, so we're always, you know, reporting side effects and things. So, you know, I can't say with 100% certainty that, you know, we'll not find something, some glitch with this vaccine. But so far, so good. That's the best we can do. Risk and benefit. I'd say the risk of not getting it is greater than the risk of getting the vaccine, based on what I know about the profile of the vaccine. Cervical cancer is very common. I've had a 18-year-old with cervical cancer already.
Really?
Correct. It takes 2 years of HPV virus to generate changes that can result in cancer of the cervix. And I think it's wise. People, I think, are concerned because it's a sexually transmitted infection. You know, my child's not going to have problems with that, whatever it may be that, you know, their objections to this are. But the truth is, you never know what your kids are going to do.
Yeah.
Their behavior is always unpredictable. This does give you some degree of protection, not 100%. And there's so many other things you have to worry about other than HPV, but at least there's one vaccine that we know does work and it is available. But obviously we stress, the fact that it's sexually transmitted and that other things can be sexually transmitted. And I think that's really important point here is that it's part of a health plan for their kids. It's just one little piece that somebody can do for their child. Mm. So, you know, you have arguments, all sorts of arguments about, well, if I'm not sexually active, I'm a virgin when I'm married, then I'm safe. Well, wrong. You can't tell about your partner's sexual history. So it becomes kind of a loose argument at best. Mm.
Well, it's certainly because it is sexually transmitted to get the benefit of the vaccine. You want to give it before a girl it becomes sexually active. But
correct.
Then there's still that question about, well, okay, at what age do you want to think about doing that? Do you want to do it, 12, 14, 16, 17?
Yeah, the target is going to be 11-year-olds, according to the AAP, American Academy of Pediatrics. But it can be given as early as 9. And a lot of kids are coming in at 10 for their fifth grade physical, and that may be the last time you'll see them for 3 years. So actually, we may choose to give it at 10. certainly the high school girls that are coming in for other reasons, even if they have a sore throat, I'll give them a handout on it. I try to give the people a handout and talk about it instead of put them in shock the first time they're in. I'd let them think about it, but say, come on back. You don't need to see me to get the vaccine. You can come in at any time. Let me tell you about it. It gives them time to think about it, but I've been encouraging people to do so.
Well, again, questions are welcome. Child health questions, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if you're listening on the air in and around Illinois and Indiana, or even people listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455.
It's interesting that Gardasil is touted as the first vaccine for cancer. It's been my understanding. But actually, hepatitis B vaccine probably was the first because people with chronic hepatitis B end up with liver cancer. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting vaccine. We'll probably start vaccinating for other cancers, too, which will be interesting.
Yeah. Now, that's also sexually primary sexual transmitted?
Yeah, for most people, hepatitis B is transmitted sexually.
So is there that same argument that people say, well, mm-hmm. If my child is not going to be sexually active, why do we need this? Give this vaccine now?
Why do we give a hepatitis B at 2 months or birth when, come on. Well, occasionally somebody slips up and is born and mom is hepatitis B positive. And that is an almost 100% transmission to the baby. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that with hepatitis B, if you develop hepatitis B early in life, in childhood, you typically become a chronic infected carrier. If you get it when you're older, there's less of a chance of developing the carrier state. So actually the more significant infections are the hepatitis B infections in kids because they end up being chronic infections. So.
Well, we have a couple of callers here. First, we'll start out and we'll talk with someone in Bement. Line number one. Right here. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
His name's Robert Thomas, Shell Doctor. Wondered, I have a terrible disease, myasthenia gravis. And does this affect children? And first question. And second, I got to go see Dr. Cranston on the 1st, MDA clinic. And I was just wondering, I think this mestinon, it doesn't seem to work as good as it used to. And I was just wondering, how safe is the Imuran? And I thought maybe ask him if he might try that.
Well, I can tell you it does happen in kids. It's not a common problem, and it's usually treated by one of our neurologists who are specialized in this area. Often the pediatrician can make a diagnosis and or suspect it, and then some tests can be done, as you know. I'm not familiar with the medication used for this particular problem in adults, and I think certainly I would refer that to Dr. Cranston.
It's bad enough having it 59 years old.
Yeah, it is. How old were you when you developed the problem?
I was a month off of 54, 53, 11 months, and I'll tell you, I can't tell you how bad I suffered with it.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for anybody that would have it. I've just been praying for remission. I was with Dr. Helfrich, and then they, MDA, said they'd pay for my my visits, but I had to go to their doctor, which is fine with me.
Yeah.
But I take mestinon, and I take mestinon time span, and I take prednisone. But the mestinon doesn't seem to work as good as it used to, so I thought I'd ask him about the Imuran. I'd like to get the immunoglobulin or the plasmapheresis, but that's really expensive.
It's pretty large measure, if you will, but it depends on your symptoms, yeah.
I guess they don't like to do it unless you have a crisis.
Right. Well, good luck to you, sir.
Yes, sir. It was nice talking
to you. Nice talking to you.
Well, thanks for the call. We're talking here this morning with Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Call Clinic, and we're thinking maybe people listening out there have questions about their children and the kids in their lives. Anything that you could think of asking a pediatrician, I know he'll do his best. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, someone who no doubt must be listening on the internet because they're in Houston, Texas. Line number
Houston.
Four.
What's Hello? The weather like?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have a question for doctor. I have a 80 years old daughter. She has allergy problem. Her doctor gave her single layer and Renacol nasal spray, And she has been on that medication for 1 month, but she has to use another 3 months. I'm just wondering, is any, you know, I'm concerned, is any side effects on that?
Well, the did you say Rhinocort?
Rhinocort nasal spray and singular.
Yes, Rhinocort, if used correct, an 8-year-old.
Yeah,
it is safe. It's very effective if used correctly for most people with allergies, and the singular is also used in allergies and asthma. It's not the first line typically for most of the pediatricians that I talk to. Usually, we'll use an antihistamine like Claritin, Loratadine, one of those. And if you failed one of the antihistamines, it's certainly a reasonable choice.
She doesn't have asthma, and the doctor is not pediatrician; it's her nose doctor.
I see.
So in the beginning, we are she is on the Claritin and singular. So I'm kind of concerned, but the doctor still let her use it another 3 months.
Yeah, I think it's a safe medicine, best we can tell.
It's singular, you say?
Yes, ma'am. I think it's perfectly safe if dosed correctly. It works reasonably well for allergies. It's just more expensive, so a lot of times
it is very expensive.
We'll try some, you know, over-the-counter antihistamines, even like Loratadine, which is Claritin, first. So.
Right. So how long she can use it? I mean, basically, there's time limits.
I don't think there's any time limits. You need to use it to control symptoms. And so with allergies, typically, if you have chronic allergies, long-term, you know, like year-round allergies, it may be helpful to find out what you're allergic to, try to eliminate from the environment or do what you can, and so to reduce the medicine load is typically what I do if somebody has really severe or chronic allergies.
Okay. She doesn't have test for, you know, for what she allergic to.
Okay. They don't know what she's allergic to yet.
I don't know. And doctor seems like doesn't let us to do some, any, you know, test,
mm-hmm.
just give her that kind of medicine. So.
Well, it's okay to, a lot of times I'll start with medicine, get symptoms controlled, and then if they're easily controlled, I will find out, you know, the season, if you will, or seasonality to it. And again, if it's just spring or fall, I'll just treat with medicine. That's fine. If I'm allergic to house dust mite or animals and I'm chronically affected by the allergies, then it may be worth looking at trying to pin those down so you can control some of those environmental triggers, especially in Houston when it's hot and humid, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is very humid.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We are at our midpoint, just about, and if there are other folks who have questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carl Clinic. I thought I'd ask you about something else. This is not exactly new, but I'm continuing to read and hear a lot about the growing problem of type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. what we used to call adult onset diabetes, type 2 diabetes, in children and adolescents, mm-hmm. where we didn't see that before. We saw the type 1, the childhood, essentially it's the kind that you're born with, but not the kind that develops. Generally, I think type 2, we start to see that in people over 50, you know, mm-hmm. around that age. And we're starting to see it more. And in fact, I came across a story that said, in fact, there was a study, I think this was done at New York University School of Medicine, where they found that between 1997 and 2003, there was a more than 170% increase in hospitalizations of children because of the type 2 diabetes. And there apparently was some indication that in children and adolescents, the complications of the type 2 diabetes can come on more quickly. That is, you know, it'll from the time that you realize you got a problem to the time that things get really bad, it's compressed. It's much shorter than it would be in adults. What should a parent be looking for if they are concerned that they might have a child that would maybe be in a pre-diabetic mm-hmm. mode?
How much time do I have?
Oh, I don't give you about 20, 25 minutes.
Okay.
It's that complicated. Huh?
When I went through training, basically 25 years ago, I didn't see a child with type 2 diabetes mm-hmm. in my practice. The kids that came in were type 1. Type 1 is totally different than type 2 in terms of how you get it, what the body is doing. Type 1, basically your body attacks your insulin-secreting cells in the pancreas and just destroys them. And it happens. You can be skinny, you can be overweight, it doesn't matter. You know, you may have other autoimmune problems such as thyroid problems and this and that. And it typically happens in young people. It's determined by genetics, believe it or not. It's just that the incidence is maybe 1 in 1,000 instead of type 2, which is more common actually. And generally, you treat with insulin. A lot of kids will come in with increased thirst, you know, drinking more, urinating more, losing weight. And hopefully they'll get in at that point before they become really ill and end up in what's called diabetic ketoacidosis. And it's pretty big problem. The type 2 it's now type 2, not adult onset, because we see it in kids now. And the reason we see it in kids is because we have the same genetic pool probably, right? What we're seeing is kids are becoming extremely overweight. And I saw a child last week who was 10. She's overweight. She's already going through puberty. And guess what? Type 2 diabetes. She has some other issues. Certain ethnic groups have a higher incidence. So it's because we're seeing obesity. I think that's the trigger for this for the most part. With type 2, what happens is as you become more overweight and you have the right genetic predisposition, your body can't keep up with the glucose. Your insulin that you secrete is just not enough to take care of your body. And then if you don't have enough insulin, then your blood sugar goes up. And then you develop the symptoms of diabetes. So being overweight puts you at what's insulin resistance is what really develops. So it's happening. It's because our population, if you trend the increase in type 2 diabetes, it trends real nicely with the incidence of overweight in childhood.
Yeah. So there, obviously, the solution, it's easy to say what the solution is. Maybe putting it in place is something else, but it basically has to do with having them have a healthy body weight. Mm-hmm. What's in the target range for them, and try to have a good diet. You know, healthy as we can make it, and have a good level of physical activity. So
correct.
That's pretty much that's pretty much the bottom line.
It's a problem for society. It's our fast foods. Both parents are working. We go out to McDonald's and eat 3 times a week. It's the internet. Sorry, it's TV. It's video games. It's a lot of things go into this, and so I don't think the pediatricians are going to fix it. But it has to be, you know, fixed at many levels. Yeah.
Well, if you say you have a child like that, a 10-year-old who's got type 2 diabetes, and I'm sure that among the first things that you do is you talk about what their diet is and their activity level. You talk about a healthy diet, the kind that's recommended for people who have diabetes. You say, look, it's important to get some regular exercise and so forth and so on. So I'm sure that's your first area of a treatment. Is that enough to get the problem under control, or do you sometimes have to start using medication?
Well, I think a lot of times the kids that have type 2 that come in that have had symptoms for a while end up actually being treated with medication, and a lot of times insulin initially, because they need to get the blood sugar down. They're running 400, 500, 600 blood sugars when it should be 120. And then once they're stabilized and you decide it's type 2, then certainly you're going to work on the diet and exercise and weight loss, whether it's type 1 or type 2. And then you see if you can wean them from their insulin and start oral medications, or see if their diet and exercise is adequate. Unfortunately, you'll probably need to talk to an adult endocrinologist, but diet and exercise are clearly the first, first-line treatment for type 2 diabetes, but a lot of people go on medication because it's not adequate.
Yeah, I guess I was just wondering whether you end up with somebody at that point where you actually have to start them, in addition to doing the other sorts of things, you have to start them on insulin, and maybe then that means they'll be taking insulin for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and I don't think you should exclude insulin from the treatment of type 2 because it's needed frequently. Mm. In type 2, eventually your pancreas just gives out and you just don't have the insulin. And so you can exercise all you want, you can lose all your weight, but you still don't have enough insulin. So it's one of those things that can happen.
Yeah, and certainly it's not the kind of, you want to take it seriously. It's not the kind of thing that you want to let go untreated because there can be all kinds of additional complications related to diabetes you just don't want to, you don't want those things to happen.
Right. It's a very significant problem. Yeah. It causes cardiovascular problems, peripheral nerve problems, eye problems, kidney problems, if not treated adequately. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's talk with somebody here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a developmental question. I have an 11-month-old boy, and he seems developmentally fine in every respect, except he's not showing any interest in crawling yet. He has, he's alert, sociable, fine motor skills manually, but just does not want to get moving, crawling, or attempt to walk or anything like that. So I wonder how much of this is a developmental indicator. How much should I be concerned about this?
Can I ask a few questions?
Uh huh.
Okay. Is he sitting?
Oh yes. Okay. Very well.
Is he up on fours? Can he get up on his knees and hands?
He does not do that.
Not yet. Okay. Doesn't pull up, then, I take it.
No, and he doesn't. We try to get him to stand, hold him up, okay. Get him holding onto a chair or something.
Okay, because he can support his weight with his legs?
Yeah.
Okay. And what does he do during the day? Is he with you or is he with a parent or other caretaker?
Combination of a parent and caretaker.
Okay. Does he use a walker or exercisor or any device?
No.
Okay. Has he been on I take it he was asleep on your back, child, and everything?
Yes.
Okay.
But he can turn over. He'll roll himself over, but he does sleep on his back all along.
Does he prefer to be on his back, or does he prefer to be on his stomach when he's...
On his back, if he's laying in bed. We'll put him on his stomach to give him some tummy time, but he'll get a little fussy after a while.
Right. I think I'll just talk in general. I see this to some degree in the office, and I think some of this is pretty common. I don't know if you have friends with kids, but what I'm seeing is there are a lot of things that have changed since the babies have been like on their back for sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to be on their belly. They don't necessarily crawl at the same time. Some of them don't walk at the same time as you might think they should. And so some of it is probably our fault in terms of the back positioning.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is I usually just have the parents make sure that they're not using any walkers or exercisers, that they're trying to spend an increasing amount of time on their belly.
Mm-hmm.
And, what do they'll tolerate? And I think that's a good start. I probably wouldn't worry much about it if there are no other problems and he's had normal development in other areas, but I would focus on a little more tummy time, if you will, and see how that works out.
Sure. Well, we saw a friend's 1-year-old, so this is just a month older, earlier this week, and their boy was not only walking around but trying to kick a soccer ball.
Yeah.
So the contrast
couldn't
have been greater.
Yeah, that's a little disturbing, I know, but very, very normal to have a fairly, large range. In other words, with the developmental kind of schemes, if you will, the kids can start walking in 8 or 9 months and mm-hmm. be as late as 16 months, and it doesn't correlate with IQ. And I don't think it correlates with how well they play soccer later, but... I guess if someone's not progressing, I would worry about it. But if you're progressing, I'd certainly bring it up with a pediatrician, but I see this frequently.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carle Clinic. We're taking questions on children's health. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. But let me just ask you about this back sleeping thing, because within the past, I don't know, how many years, few years, 5-6 years, the recommendation really has been to put children to sleep on their back, particularly don't put them on their tummies, face down, there was some concern that stomach sleeping might be implicated in sudden infant death syndrome. And in fact, I think someone did some study of that. And so I think the recommendation was, okay, make sure that they sleep on their... We're not really quite sure what's going on with SIDS, but sleeping on the back, that's a good thing. That's still what we're saying?
That is huge. When I, again, came out of training, the nursery nurse would just flip her top if I left a baby on the back because the baby had to be on their belly. But what happened was in Australia, some people were observant, and they noted that babies were often found face down in SIDS situations. And so what they did was they did a national study where they took a large number of babies and had them sleep on their back and had babies sleep on their stomach. And after about a year, they realized, my gosh, this group is really having problems, the ones that are on their belly. So they interrupted the study and basically published it. And everyone went to the back sleeping probably a couple of years later when another study was done that also verified that. So that is huge. That cut back on the SIDS rate 50% or more in Australia. Mm-hmm. So it clearly has to do with the fact that when babies sleep on their face or on their abdomen, they can bury their face in their crib mattress and sheets, and then they don't respond to their own, carbon dioxide levels and things of this sort as well. And also they do sleep better on their belly, but that may be a negative. Mm-hmm. On your back, you don't have the rebreathing issues, you don't have the problem with your face up against a mattress, and also you don't sleep quite as well, no doubt. Babies have more interrupted sleep, and that has really paid off. But in doing so, a couple things have happened. I think that one is kids, their development has changed. There's a book, I forgot, Doc, Why Is My Baby Crawling, and something else, and it relates to this. And then two is we're seeing a lot of kids with flat heads or misshapen heads. Because they're sleeping, it's funny, kind of, but not. But where their head will kind of shift based on which side they like. If they lay on the right side, they have a flattened head on that side, and it shifts the ears, and the whole head looks a little lopsided. And we've had to do some work there to offset some of that. But that, I guess, it's minor compared to SIDS.
Oh, yeah.
And there's other causes of SIDS. One of the things that I want to certainly bring up, I think, in terms of, pediatricians deal a lot with prevention, and certainly SIDS is one. A safe crib is really important, making sure that it's up to standards. The slats should be a certain length, distance apart. The mattress should be firm. You shouldn't leave things in there that the baby can get the face up against. It can cause suffocation later on, things in the crib that they can hang themselves on. So it's really important not only to sleep on your back, but to pay attention to your crib, your crib safety. Make sure you have smoke alarms, carbon dioxide detectors, and those kind of simple things are really important. So it's more than just sleeping on your back.
Okay, very good.
And don't smoke around your kids. And if you can give up smoking, that would help.
That would be a good thing for everybody. All right.
Yes.
We have a couple of callers here, someone on a cell phone, so we'll get to them next. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, sleep problems as well, but this time with a 3.5-year-old. He's been a great sleeper since he was 10 weeks old. But in the past 4 months, he started multiple night wakings where he's come into our room. At times he's been screaming but not sleepwalking, I don't think because he'll talk to us normally and remember it the next morning. But now it's at the point where he just comes in, says, Mommy, take me back. I do it without saying a word, take him back to his room, put him in his bed. But this all happened last night. It was 4 times a night. So leaving everybody in the house exhausted. We've tried punishments. We've tried rewards. We've tried cutting down naps. We've tried different bedtimes. And is this a developmental thing? Is this something, any bright ideas for tired mommies?
Okay. Woof. I know what I've been through this, by the way, 3 years of age.
yes.
Talk to my son. The... Is he has a regular bedtime?
He does.
Okay.
In the summer, it's probably been pushed up till 8. Usually it's 7:30.
Okay. And naps are regular?
Naps are very regular. He'd sleep probably 2 hours, from 1:30 to 3:30, 1 mm-hmm. to 3, something like that.
Okay. And at bedtime, do you have a little routine going that's pretty
Absolutely.
Standard?
Yep, and he for a while he was getting out multiple times when we would put him to bed, and now that stopped. He comes out once and asks for water and then goes back and it's fine.
So he falls asleep without you being in the room?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, you're doing great then. And then the other thing, too, is when he wakes up, he wants to go back to bed. You take him back to his own bed?
Right, after about a month of him coming into bed with us, I'm also pregnant, so I can't deal with that anymore.
Okay.
He is going back. He just seems to want the company and want the security.
He just wants to check on you, wants to make sure you're okay, I think, so probably. No, maybe not, but you're doing everything you can. I think that's reasonable. You know, you've set the limits. You're bringing him back to bed. I guess, you know, other than just say, hey, you know, if you stay in your bed, that would be great for mommy. Mommy gets some sleep, you get some sleep. Is there anything I can provide you that would help you? And, you know, you may want to set up a positive reward system. Three-year-olds you can sometimes buy off. You wouldn't believe. I bought off my son, which was amazing. He's going to kill me. They're telling the story. But same thing. It was driving me crazy. He'd be standing over my bed at 3 a.m. and I'd be going, what? I can't sleep. So, we kind of set up a positive reward system. And he bought into it. And he gets up in the morning, goes, I did it. And, you know, I mean, I guess put some control in his hands and give him a little responsibility, maybe a little, and see what you can do. I think he's kids go through physiologic waking. They just do it. It goes through cycles for whatever reason. And you may not even know they're up, especially the young ones. They'll just go back to sleep. We all do that. And so he'll probably eventually cycle out of it. But you're maintaining routines. You're doing everything appropriately. That's really wonderful. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. On to someone also on cell phone, line number 4. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
My question is a follow-up on the one regarding Singular and Claritin. I have a 2.5-year-old grandson who's been on both Singular and Claritin for probably over a year, and it sounded to me like maybe it's either one or the other. Or is there any problem with them using both?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, no. I think I would obviously start with one, the simplest and least expensive. And if that's not satisfactory and I've done everything else, then adding another medication is not rare, whether it be Singular or a corticosteroid nasal spray if you're older. And then, of course, if it's chronic, I still get back to the theme that if I can eliminate whatever is bothering me, it would make pretty good sense.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have any of the allergy symptoms of the runny nose and the eyes, itchy eyes and things. He's only 2.5, but he does have a cough at the night, so they're giving him a Pulmicort also before he goes to bed.
Right.
So that's what I wondered. He's been the one thing that's been constant has been the Singular. If you're going to decrease something or stop one or the other, you would suggest stopping the Singular and see if the Claritin would cover it.
Well, is the child having problems coughing at night at this time?
When he gets a cold, they think it might be viral asthma, and so
right.
When he gets a cold, the cough hangs on and on and on, and she finds that he can go to bed, he might be all day without cough, but about 10:30, 11:30 in the night, he has his coughing spell, so to prevent her from having to get up and to take care of it, then she's been doing it before he goes to bed with the nebulizer.
Right. Well, I think, you know, if you have some suspicion or you have a diagnosis of asthma, Singular has a couple of advantages. It really treats both problems.
Uh-huh.
And so it's pretty good choice. It's not necessarily first line. Pulmicort's a very reliable medicine if used appropriately.
Uh-huh.
So I can't recommend stopping anything at this point if you're having nocturnal symptoms. But I think the catch here is that they're suspicious of asthma. So that, like, for instance, Claritin, it may be helpful to some degree, but it's not going to be an adequate treatment for asthma. And Pulmicort can help. Albuterol can help.
Suspecting asthma.
Yeah. There's general rules. If somebody with asthma is waking up more than twice a month. Are you on a cell phone? Sorry.
The caller's kind of breaking up on us.
I'll just tell you, if somebody has asthma and they're waking up more than twice a month with cough. We call that persistent asthma, and those people really need to be on maintenance medications like Pulmicort and Singulair, and they need to, you know, do well. If they're not, then you go back and you reevaluate and see what else they need. So there's you know, it's kind of complicated, and I can only give you general advice.
All right. Well, again, I hope that that helps.
I wanted to bring up one other thing with the young lady with the 3-year-old that was waking. I didn't ask any specific questions about medications, you know, that might be interfering with sleep, family history of sleep problems, or snoring. I think that's one thing that you want to make sure that somebody's not doing, waking with snoring. They found mother is very familiar with sleep problems, obviously. She knows about night terrors and things of this sort. I can tell by her comments. But they found that a good percentage of kids with night terrors were actually waking or partially waking because they were having obstructive apnea. So at least take a look at the breathing, too. Yeah. And I apologize for not discussing that with
if all other things being equal, if child appears to be healthy and you're still saying that, you know, it may be one of those things that you just kind of live through, write it out, and chances are it will go away.
Right. All right. Usually. If not, then talk to your pediatrician.
Yeah. And on the subject of allergies, I'm sure that I know this is – I'm sure you deal with this, although there are also people who are specialists, who pediatric allergists, who that's the whole thing that they do. With someone where you suspect you have a pretty good idea that someone has allergies, you can treat the symptoms. I guess, though, one of the questions is at some point you think, well, is it really important for us to know what the allergen is? And so then you start into doing – you do your skin scratch test just like they've been doing now for a long, long time. And I guess there are also blood tests that you can do that as well. When has it become important for you actually to know what it is that's causing the problem?
Well, I think any life-threatening reaction would be a good idea. I mean, people with shellfish or peanut allergies, I mean, they can have really big problems just very suddenly. So, and they need – I think – they need a lot of education. They need epinephrine pins and things of the sort. And I think an allergist is a good source of information and can do the appropriate things. They usually would do blood testing in that situation and not try to give them a skin test, which could trigger reaction. In the office. And I think that's one indication. The couple of other indications is if I have a child with asthma and I'm having trouble controlling their asthma, I'm very suspicious that they're – allergies are driving, and I'll go ahead and allergy test because there are a lot of environmental triggers for asthma, which include house dust mite, mold, cats, dogs, this kind of thing. I use the allergist in that situation. Or if I'm on several allergy medications and it's a year-round phenomena, I mean, I just think if I can control the environment, if I can eliminate something from the environment – and help my symptoms. I think that's certainly logical. And I do some allergy testing myself sometimes. I'll do some of the blood testing called RAST testing. And there's a couple of other versions of that now. But I don't do skin testing. Sometimes I'll refer them if it's more complicated. Because a history does help a lot in terms of deciding what you're going to test for, because aren't there a million antigens out there, things that you might be allergic to? So you have to use the history and your wisdom to decide what to check for.
Yeah. We have a couple of minutes left here. Something I'm sure that you would like to have the chance to talk about because, you know, you talked earlier about interest in prevention. You want to talk about bike helmets?
Ooh, well, first of all, I want to mention Playing It Safe is June 2nd, and that's at the fairgrounds, and that's our injury prevention fair. So please bring your kids out. We usually have thousands of people come through, and we'll talk about bike helmets, bicycle safety, water safety. We'll have fire, police, you name it. It's a great, great thing. But, you know, I think bicycles, anything with wheels is a potential injury waiting to happen. And I think you can take precautions. I mean, I'm a biker. I wear a helmet all the time. I try to dress properly. And I think parents should certainly set a good example by wearing helmets, dressing appropriately, making sure their bike's in good order, and have their kids wear the helmets. It's a problem because we don't have a law. I tried. We don't have a law with nothing to enforce, so that parents are left with, oh, come on, wear it. And if the Johnny next door is not wearing their helmet, Jimmy's not going to wear his helmet. It's just one of those geek factors. So clearly we're not doing quite enough in that area. But in general, I think with skating, rollerblading, bikes, you need to wear helmets. It's interesting, though, that when I was growing up, no one was wearing helmets when they were skiing either. Now I'm seeing that that's kind of a standard for a lot of ski resorts, is wearing helmets when you ski.
Really?
I wasn't aware of that. And actually, ice skating was up there number one or two for head injuries for falls. I didn't realize that either until some recent reports. So I think there's other areas, too, that we neglect to deal with. But bicycles are a biggie. Summers, you know, everybody's out on their bikes. But make sure that, you know, you're wearing a helmet, your chain's on. I've seen so many chain injuries. Chain falls off and, you know, the kid's pedaling standing up. Brakes fail. Tires aren't good. So, you know, take a look at your bikes. Make sure they're working well.
Yeah.
Before you hit the streets.
Obviously, we want them to be out there active, and that contributes to general health. But we also don't want them to end up getting hurt as a result of the physical
activity. And our trauma service reports and a lot of kids that aren't wearing their helmets are injured and head injuries. So if you wear a helmet, you're going to reduce your head injury by 50% or better, you know, and that's really important statistic.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm sure that one of the big things, if parents are cyclists, that seeing them wear the helmet, that's a good thing. I don't know if you could figure out some way to make helmet wearing cool. Now the Pediatric Academy would have a big award for you
if somebody could
figure that out. I don't know how it is that you do that.
They've done some things. Some sports idols have been out on wheels with helmets in Chicago and some of these bigger cities, and they've used celebrities to promote helmet use, but it's a battle. The statistics are, unless you have a law, unless you enforce it, and Atlanta's a good example, you will not see increased use of bicycle helmets. I've tried to impress that upon people, but I don't. It's not a popular item with the police or with the city because it would take a lot of resources. At least that's their bent to really patrol it, and I think they think they have other things they need to be doing, but it would be time consuming for them. But yeah. I think it would be worthwhile.
All right. Well, at that, we'll say thanks very much to our
guest,
Dr. Hill, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's pediatrician at Carle Clinic in Urbana. I appreciate it very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.